Curtis Greco, author of the Blind Vision series. He's the founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. And we loved him so much last month, we brought him back. Hello, Curtis. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Good evening, Denny. How are you?
I am very blessed, sir. How about you?
I just was wiping my brow. I was rocking out here in the office at that great funky music.
Yeah, I bet you were. Yeah, I've seen your picture. You look like an old funk master yourself from the days gone by. You look like you could really cut a rug with the white man overbite going there on the dance floor.
Oh, yeah.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog, doo-doo-doo, was a good friend of mine.
Tell him to stop, Curtis.
Yeah, play that funky music, white boy.
That's it, man. Classic song right there, One Hit Wonders from Wild Cherry. All right, so you're still at the office. Come on, go home. Be with your family.
Hey, there's a mission. There's a message. We've got to save somebody.
All right, hold on. Before we get to that, the conversation we've been having for the last hour has been pretty good. I am disgusted that Black Friday is no more because Thanksgiving now is just another regular shopping day. Have you heard Walmart, Target, all these stores in California? I don't know, because that may have been going on for 10 years. You guys are so lost. But here in Georgia, they're all going to be open now. So Black Friday has lost the meaning for these boobs that have no lives that want to get up at 4 in the morning and go shopping. And it bothers me because Thanksgiving is supposed to be a day of family and friends and giving thanks to God our Creator.
I caught on your the lead into the segment, and I can't agree with you more. I mean, you know, our nation has lost a sense of deferential reverence in many different areas, and you know, and I find the same observation as equally as appalling as you do, that there is no call, there is no set aside, there is no, again, I think it's a great phrase, there is no deferential reverence to things worth cherishing, things worth preserving. And I was keyed in on that, the comment of your last caller, Catherine, and the comments that she was making, and your response in particular, that there is, that we, the segment of the population that is the fundamental flavor of what lies back of we hold these truths to be self-evident, and the foundations of this country are so silent on these issues, and I'm troubled by it. I'm very troubled by it.
I am also. All right, you got any comments or questions for my guest? 770-226-0920. Outside of Atlanta, 888-920-2665. All right, so I got your books. Thank you for sending them. I just started reading the first one. Gene, for whatever reason, started with book three. I started with We Hold These Truths, and then the second one is Value Given, Value Received, and Valor in Prosperity. How are the books selling?
They're doing well. They're doing well. I mean, most of the, you know, the approach that my processes are taking is really based on a groundswell of interest on the public. The you know, they're making their way. I've got a great distance to go with them, because I think that, you know, ultimately, as I'm looking for critical mass, because I think that ultimately the appearance of the books to many people first, when they first start reading them, think of them somewhat as an academic expose, and they're not. They are one man's intensely personal view of what constitutes our nation's foundations and a foundation, and how by various events, various transgressions and departures away from those principles that we have landed where we are today.
So, Curtis, why three books? Why not just one killer?
Well, there's
one big one, one really big one.
Well, because, you know, I find that, you know, most people are do not take the time to read. They're getting their sound bites from news shows.
Talk radio.
There's talk radio too, but, you know, the great thing about talk radio is that our hosts and shows just like yours that go into specific points and literally dissect them and look for what's behind what is being told and what is being printed. And so I had to personally, with the advice, and I think very good advice from my editor, was to, in fact, break the books out into topical references, precisely to cover the key points. Well, the things we hold to be true, value given, value received, which is a fundamental balance that is required for an economic environment, the fundamental balance of trust that lies behind any qualitative notions that are engaged or critical to any relationship, whether it's a marriage, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a business transaction. And then the last book, Valor and Prosperity, it takes a look at the combination of books 1 and 2, and then concludes with a discussion on what constitutes or what can we do to reconstitute those fundamentals. And I thought that it was best to take it on a 3-prong approach, because I'm counting on people taking them in bite size, because they're not, I readily admit, they're not Harlequin romances. They're not, you know, something that you're going to sit and have a Harry Potter moment over them. They are want-to-read books. I mean, if your listeners and the folks who are out there truly have a concern over what's happening with the country and truly have a desire to see a true resurrection or true restoration, they really need to see a perspective that is really uncommon. And that's really what the books do. There's a blend of a variety of different writing styles in there. There's a variety of different inserts of personal commentaries that I've made over the years. There's some poetry in there and excerpts from historical novels. There's a lot of quotes. I've even got Don Quixote, in there. So all with a keen desire to accentuate the issues by using historical references.
My guest is Curtis Greco. The website is theimperfectmessenger.com. I have it linked up on Denny Radio. I'm reading 3 different books right now, including yours, Curtis, and all 3 are from interviews that I've done. I'm just fascinated by this. Gene's got a question for you.
Well, go for it.
I was hearing what you're saying, hearing what you and Denny are saying, but I don't tie my Christianity in with the machinations of this country. Were there no country, I would still hope that I'd be a Christian. Were I born in another country, I'd still hope that I would have been shown the Lord. It's in every big situation, every major issue in this country, it seems like it happened with or without Christianity. Most of it was racial with the Civil War or whatever. Things didn't happen because the Christians said such and such. They happened because the country stood up and said enough of this. With the child labor laws in the early 1900s and the robber bans, all of these things, you would think that if this were a Christian nation, the Christians would stand up and say, oh, this is not Christ-like. Those things, I don't think you tie your Christianity in with what the nation does, positive, left, right, good, bad, or other things.
I appreciate the point, Gene. There's a couple points I'd like to give you in response to that, and there's 3 of them. Number one, remember that when Jesus was on the planet, he taught a perspective of Judaism that had been uncommon for his day. The exposure of what he taught created chaos in that environment, the price of which cost him his life, right?
But that was his plan.
Well, absolutely.
That was God's plan.
Absolutely. The number one. But what we all need to remember about this concept of Christianity, now I confess I'm a Roman Catholic, but and that's only just to put it out there, so the comment that's about to come won't appear as to be that I'm taking an opposing view. But there was no Catholic Church in the time of Christ. There was Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was not a Buddhist. Jesus was not a Muslim. Jesus was not a Lutheran. He was not an Anglican, et cetera, et cetera. He was a Jew. And the critical point about that is that the fundamentals of the lesson, to address your comment about whether or not things would have happened either way or either way, with or without Christianity, is to go back to the root discussion of what constitutes the fundamental principles that lie back of good living, good fundamental natural law living, the very fundamentals that exist in the Ten Commandments. These points, your point is well taken, and I address it this way. The Constitution or the Declaration of Independence is not taught as a spiritual document, but it is an intensely spiritual document. It is a document that ties man's existence to a providential design, which is identified as the Creator. It expresses in there, I have a saying, and it says this: man must be free for independence to be at liberty to be expressed. This is the fundamentals of my opposition to the way government has gone. This is why when you look at the Declaration of Independence and you have arguments of juxtapositions to the arguments against the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that defines separation of church and state, in and on its own is professed to the public as if it's a contradiction, but in fact it's an affirmation of what lies in the Declaration of Independence. for man, or if you look at even within the short history of the United States, the 200-plus years, our failings have been because we have confused the role of government as designed with a purpose being something other than that. We have turned government into a social experiment. We have turned it into a form of enforcement of social fad and design, when in fact, which is why we get these variations. The other day I was asked, why do you have a problem with the government in dealing with economic issues in Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare? And the reason's real simple, is those are social mandates. Those are social experiments. That is not representative government. And by design, the U.S. form of government is not designed, nor is it intended, to be an economic extension, nor an extension of transient social paradigms.
Point well taken, but if the government sees a sector of its population starving, isn't it in the national interest to say, here is a level that you cannot fall. We will help you stay above a certain level. Now, you can argue, is the level too high? If you have a cable television, you know, you should. That's kind of high for an American poor person. But you should not starve on the street. It's not a social experiment. The government says that we won't allow people to fall below a certain point in this society. Otherwise, we're just anarchy.
Hold on. I mean, I see where Gene's going, and our heart as Christians pours out to people. But the problem is the government has turned it into big business for the purpose of getting votes and getting reelected.
I agree.
People get on the gravy train, and they don't ever want to get off.
I agree.
Because, you know, you have generations. It starts with one generation, and then kids grow up in that, and they say, well, the government will just take care of me, and that they have no expectation.
Right.
At some point, you got to get off.
So the government's bad at it.
Exactly.
Good intention.
The government's not willing to say, this is all you get after that, you're on your own.
Okay. I mean, go ahead,
to take the point in an inverse argument, Gene, is the comment about slavery and the comment about the Constitution, in my comment about the Constitution. You know, the Constitution did not mandate slavery, okay? The Constitution was ambiguous as to the resolution regarding slavery. But if you take that point and juxtapose it to your comment about Christianity, wouldn't on its own, just without the relevant issues of governance, wouldn't the idea of slavery been wrong on its own? Did it take government to define that slavery was wrong? Of course not. So my point being is that when you look even today at government and the way and the environment that we live in with just take the economics of what's taking place in the United States, it is emblematic of my point, and that is government became a means with which to attempt to socialize the processes of business. And business discovered, conversely, that it could acquire the mechanisms of government to attempt to further its interests.
Well, that's it, right there.
Okay, and so in the construct of what we're addressing, whether it be the issue of the fundamentals of a secular society, a good living, like Merkel mentioned about to the Christian Democrats, that's the irony of all of this, is that in a nation such as this, that's very foundations lie in a very basic principle of trust, which is on its own a form of an extension of natural law or an extension of the very teachings that Jesus taught and in other religions as well, that we fail to understand that integral to a successful practices of government and successful business practices and success within our personal relationships, that the very fundamental law we violate on a regular basis, trust. Okay, and in book two, in part of book one, when you get to it, Denny and Gene, there is a comment in there where I talk about, and it's on a recent post of mine, and it in the foundation, and I'm going to try to pick it up here real quick if I can while I'm stalling.
Okay, well let me get to a quick break. You can look for it, and then we'll come back and we'll start right there.
Excellent.
All right, don't move.
Denny Schaefer.
My guest is Curtis Greco, founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation.com. I have it linked up on DennyRadio.com. Go there, buy his books, make them rich. I'm Denny Schaefer. It's Denny Radio, 20 past the hour. You're listening to Talk 920. Curtis, welcome back to the broadcast.
All right, guys.
Did you find what you were looking for?
Yes. And by the way, it's a great post. It's called The Outcome of Pelagius. It's my most recent perch on the post on the Foundation's website. And it goes like this. This is an excerpt from book number one, We Hold These Truths. It says, "The people's greatest torment is neither fear nor so much as the abandonment of their moral compass. No, it's more likely that it is their sense of duty and honor that has been so corrupted by the complete and utter disbelief that their own have so willingly and so recklessly violated their trust." This is a powerful statement having to do with some of these very topics that we've been kibitzing over, Gene and Denny, that the thing that we need to really get to in this country is to remember that we can have a rather big umbrella and a big tent to cover a lot of people. But the government, in the extension of its duties, is not an extension of impulse. It is an extension of a fundamental belief in the sovereignty and the divinity of man. It is not the role of government to attempt, as it has done, to orchestrate divisive interests and selective interests at the expense of sovereign individuals. Last point. One of the things that folks have to understand about what constitutes a monopoly. A monopoly is not necessarily because an entity controls a market. It is more so because that entity is fearful of the free market forces of liberty and chooses and attempts to control an environment in order to orchestrate what it wants to occur. And so, that's it in a nutshell. So whenever you look at government, and it's not a question of whether or not we as a society should not take care of one another, or we as a society should not look out for the hungry, the infirmed, the downtrodden, et cetera, but is it a necessity, is it purposeful, is it proper that we should enforce that intention through government? Be good or you'll go to jail, right? Or give money, and if you don't, I'll take it to give to another. I mean, these are principles that I believe that as we look at the progress of this country and we look at what made it successful and we look at where we are today, you can clearly, anyone who takes a moment and sits back and makes the fundamental observations of what has taken place, what we have done is attempted to make universal a flawed argument, and that is not only are people entitled to success, but it is a social mandate that they be successful at the expense of someone else. And I find that to be not only Christian-like, for the lack of a better word, and unsustainable, but it's fundamentally and patently unsustainable.
Well, aren't you basically saying being all things to all people, government, basically, in a nutshell, in layman's terms? Isn't that what our government's trying to do, and they want to be paid back with votes?
Right. Well, absolutely. And that's, the only reason why these programs, look at the U.S. Government's budget, almost two-thirds of it is mandate expenditures. They talk about they're saying they're going to cut discretionary spending by $200 billion. Well, that's pennies compared to what the entitlement budgets are, what the non-discretionary budget is. If you really want to do an economic cleansing of the U.S. government, I wouldn't worry about the discretionary spending because that can be handled through the budgetary process.
All right, Curtis, I want to play something for you. This is on CBS News talking about the debt, and then I want you to comment on that.
And here's a sobering number. If $1 per second went toward the national debt, it would take 425,000 years to pay it off.
Wow. That kind of puts it in a whole new perspective, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Book two talks about this. The reality of the U.S. form of U.S.'s monetary system is this. It is mathematically unsustainable. It is not possible to pay off the government's debt because with every dollar you need to create to pay off a dollar of debt, you have a fundamental companion that trails that dollar along the way. And
so you're not saying it's unfixable, are you?
Well, it's everything's fixable. Everything, even
okay,
our most.
Okay, good. I want to make sure. I want to make sure after reading these three books, I'm like, oh man, I'm never having that guy on again. What a bummer he is.
No. That's the beauty of my outlook on life and in my outlook for our country is I do believe that, you know, one of the great lines of the memorial for Teddy Kennedy was his son who made a comment that of what he learned from his father, the late senator, and he said that one of the things I learned from my father that was this. Even our most profound failures are ultimately survivable. Now that's grace. Now that's redemption. And I believe, you know, I believe in the fundamental truth that lies back of God's intention when he decided that he would create this goofy-looking creature called humans, that we are intended to do profound and amazing things. We are designed with an inalienable compass and an inalienable corporal form that links us to a sovereign and divine entity that enables us, that's created this magnificent universe specifically to provide for his created. Now, with that kind of legacy, can we not just come to an understanding with one another that we can surely do better than we have?
But, Curtis, we both know that most people really don't give God the time of day unless they're in trouble.
Well, you know, that one just took the air right out of my lungs.
I mean, come on, we both know that. I mean, we've all been there. I've been there in my faith where I'm just going through the motions, you know, get up, do a little devotion time, give God a little nod, and go, all right, I'm going to go off my own strength, try to have a great day, as opposed to getting on my knees. I mean, just look at what folks are going to be doing on Thanksgiving, the day we're supposed to give thanks to God of family and friends and food and shelter.
Right.
All the stores are going to be open and people are going to be out shopping. And I guarantee you it'll be busy.
Yes. And what's really amazing about that is that point we started the segment on, and that is the lack of deferential reverence to sit and think about what the whole purpose of Thanksgiving is all about and why it is it should be a sovereign and sacred day for this country. And tragic that in the pursuit of trying to pump some numbers in a failing and dying economy that anybody with a brain is going to know is unsalvageable as it is simply going to be a waste of time. I mean, look at the $600 billion of quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve. Has anybody asked the question, isn't it strange that within 2 weeks after that event that the GM IPO released?
That is kind of interesting. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's just strange to me. I mean, you know, the government's numbers for the General Motors, they're talking about having it be, you know, that's made three consecutive quarters of profitability. But the reality is that the General Motors has to be able to be valued at book value at $70 billion for the U.S. government to break even $1. And it's not even anywhere near that. I mean, if you take the three quarters.
And yet they're saying how it's such a huge success. Obama was walking around like a proud rooster.
Well, I mean, what else is Mr. Obama going to do?
Well,
I mean,
he's had a bad couple of weeks.
He's had a tough couple of weeks. And of course, you know, the public is ganged up on him. And, you know, the world leaders at the G20 didn't genuflect in his general direction. And
well,
you know,
the same thing that happened here with the voters. They bought the line of goods and then they realized 2 years into it, hey, this guy is not what we thought he was.
Right, and of course now George Soros isn't particularly pleased with Mr. Obama's popularity, and he's about to toss him into the Vegematic as well. So
he's already said months ago that he's not happy with Obama. Matter of fact, he said he was sitting the midterms out. He's so disgusted with the Democrats, which I don't believe for a second that he did.
Yeah, no, it's part and parcel of the same discussion. Outlook over the horizon on these issues, you know, we did a recent discussion on the issue of jobs and some of the things that we need to be looking at in order to reinvent the economic engine of this country. And they're still talking about, from the Debt Commission, they're talking about that they're going to reduce corporate taxes. Well, that's a stroke of genius. And at the same time, they're going to now revoke. In a dying real estate economy, they're teasing the conversation with the idea of pooling the home mortgage deduction for individuals, but in the same breath, not removing it from the deductibility of the interest of mortgages on corporate holdings. I find that ironic.
Why would you do anything that could mess with the housing market that has been in the tank for all these years? Why would you even go near it right now? Until other things are stabilized, like, I don't know, unemployment?
Yeah, I mean, everything that they are doing and everything that they're looking at is window dressing, when in reality what the areas that they need to be, and if we've got time and I've got some, points that we could cover of things to do's, which are some excerpts from the book 3, but the reality is you have individuals who are losing and continuing to lose their homes at record rates. Today, if you took all of the homes that are in foreclosure and are sitting in the portfolios of lenders right now, at the current sales rate across the nation, it would take nearly 10 years to liquidate the single-family dwellings now in portfolio or in foreclosure status. 10 years.
Wow.
Okay? So if you go back and you look at the great failures that have occurred and in the economy, they are doing nothing to address the fundamental problem, and that is insufficient income in the hands of the most potentially productive class of the population.
Middle class.
Well, we call traditionally the middle class. I call it the productive class. They tell you that employment is 9.6%, but they're only talking about the people who have lost or have not found jobs in the last 6 months or past that, who failed or stopped, who are still partially looking for jobs, that are still on the rolls receiving unemployment. But they're not telling you about the chronic unemployed. They're not telling you about the self-employed people who are not W-2 wage earners, that are not measured in the equation. I ran quick numbers on self-employed business failures, self-employed participants in partnerships, business closures, and I find that the statistics regarding unemployment are actually closer to 31%.
Wow.
Okay.
Now, let me ask you a question, because we're about out of time, and we're just going to have you back, because every time we have you on, we never get everything discussed, so we're just going to keep having you back. Is that okay?
That's excellent. I love this. I love being with you on the show. You're an incredible host. You're incredibly intuitive, and I swear, I sure hope that the Atlanta audience really appreciates what you do, because you are truly
wow.
extraordinary.
And you're obviously a drinker. So, thank you. You're very kind.
No, and
let me just ask you this. What the productive class, I mentioned middle class, you said it's the productive class. What annual salary is the productive class? Because I'm not sure where that is.
Well,
what are they making?
It depends on who it is you're talking to.
Well,
okay?
I want to know if I'm in there. They say the middle class, and who's the rich, and where's the cutoff?
Well, the household income numbers are typically in the 135,000+ household income. Is where the break off starts, where you start to get up into the upper class. But the reality of it is that
I'd have to have 3 talk show jobs to get near that number.
Well, it's a great way to categorize and box people into categories and then give them nice little nifty little labels. But the reality of it is the government has failed miserably. Industry has failed miserably. Our banking system has failed miserably. And our representatives in both houses have failed miserably. And every state in the union's legislators, with few exceptions, there's some pretty standout states out there. But I mean, here in my home state of California, I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, I don't know what else to say other than to really just beg the other 49 states in the union to go to and get on their knees and pray for California, because this state is in an absolute tailspin, borrowing $40 million a day from the federal government, which is, by the way, the other 49 states, $40 million a day just to pay unemployment benefits. Okay?
Yep, and those 99 weeks, baby. Keep
okay.
them coming.
And California is it's going to be a rough couple of years out here because of the fact that the state has done everything possible to prevent economic productivity in the state. Everything
unbelievable.
Possible.
He's Curtis Greco, founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. His website is linked up at dennyradio.com, theimperfectmessengerfoundation.com. And he has a series of books called Blind Vision. When we talk next, Curtis, hopefully I'll be most of the way through at least the first book, because, like I said, I got 3 books going, and Gene's got 3 books going. Gene's a lot faster reader than I am, so we'll get a little deeper into it. We'll get deeper into the discussion. We'd love having you on. And maybe we'll have you on a little earlier so we don't run out of time.
Hey, well, Denny, again, I was sincere in my comments and my accolades toward you. You're an extraordinary man, and I'm grateful. Gene, keep an eye on him. Keep him safe. And when we talk next, I'll certainly look forward to it and welcome the opportunity. Bless your hearts to all of you, to you both, and to your listeners. And happy Thanksgiving. And if we don't talk before Christmas, Merry Christmas to everyone.
Oh, we will. We'll talk, I promise. Curtis, God bless you.
Danny Schaefer.
All right, any comments, call the show, 770-226-0920.